Welcome to another episode of Beyond Sermons, where we seek Jesus Christ beyond the pulpit. We're going to continue with our discussion on eternal security, but from a Calvinistic perspective with Jeff Laird.
How, as a Christian, a man or a woman, whoever's listening, can make that kind of adjustment judgment between blatant, you know, sin versus quote unquote accidental sin, you know?
Yeah, I would, when it comes to that sort of thing, I think the number one thing to do is draw a nice dark line around yourself and keep the judgment inside the line as much as you can. In other words, in your own life, that's the reason that Scripture warns so much about test yourself, see if you're in the faith, don't fall away, you know, make your calling and election sure, because we can fool ourselves, because there's things we want to think and we want to believe. And the only person whose attitudes and actions I can control are mine. The only person whose inner thoughts I can even come close to understanding are mine. Now, that doesn't mean I can't make reasonable judgments about what other people are saying and doing and how they're living. I just need to recognize that I have 1,000 times as much ability to judge my own relationship with Christ as I do somebody else's. It's not that I have zero ability. I just need to remember that what may be obvious for me in my own life, I'm not going to be able to parse those subtle differences in someone else's life.
Suppose you're in a situation where you need to test someone's spirit, you know, for perhaps test a false prophecy or something of that nature. When is it okay to come outside of your black circle around yourself?
I do think that questions always help. Relationship is always meaningful. I think context is a big deal in that person's life and in other things. You need to have the opportunity to see the broad strokes of what this person is saying, doing, teaching. I think the reason that Paul tells us so often that we need to bear with each other, that we need to, you know, not get involved in meaningless arguments, is that we need to look at those things from the foundational level. So if I'm going to, as you say, test the spirits with another person, I think that's going to come down a lot to the really big issues. In other words, I need to know where this person is coming from when it comes to the fundamentals of their relationship with Jesus Christ, not necessarily trying to get into the little nitpicky stuff or the nitty gritty kinds of things. In other words, I can't talk to somebody for 5 minutes and then decide, okay, this person is or isn't a legitimate believer, or this person is or isn't a heretic. That's the kind of thing that we just don't have the perception to do. So what I need to do is I need to focus on those large scale ideas. And over time, and depending on where the person's coming from, that's where I'm going to have the opportunity to make those judgments.
Okay. All right. Speaking of judgment, let's go back to the Bible.
Sure.
Luke 22, verse 3, as well as John 13, verse 27. Did Judas of Iscariot lose salvation when Satan entered him?
Okay. I think a good way to look at this question, did Judas lose salvation when Satan entered him, is to drive back to that same question we talked about before, which is, how are we defining salvation? What does it mean to be a Christian? And I think when it comes to Judas, we see a lot of signs in his life leading up to the moment where he actually makes this betrayal that suggests that he's not fully on board. He's not as committed as Peter. In fact, there's a point when Jesus is talking with the disciples and Peter says, he speaks for the 12 and he says, we believe this. And Jesus says, yeah, well, one of you is a devil. Even then, Jesus knows that one of these people is not really on board with the program. So I think there's a difference between talking about Judas finally reaching, say, a point of no return. In other words, Judas finally getting to a point where God is saying, I've done everything that I am willing to do, and now you're on your own. Proverbs 29:1, I think, you know, says a person who stiffens his neck eventually is going to be cut off suddenly, and there's not going to be any rescue for that. In other words, I don't think that Judas had any salvation to lose. I think that at worst, what we see is that's the point where Judas finally resisted God to the point that God took his hands off and said, that's it.
Okay. What do you mean by cut off according to Proverbs 29 verse 1? Cut off from what?
I think what we see in Scripture is that God does respect a measure of our free will. And I think as we get into these conversations about eternal security, I think even in the life of a believer, there are times where God does the same thing a parent does, where the parent says, I will tolerate, I will talk, I will speak up to a certain point. But then there comes a time when there's consequences. Okay. And depending on what you're talking about, those consequences can be more or less, more severe or less severe. And I think there are times where at some point God says, I've made my good faith effort, so to speak, to show you, to demonstrate, to reach you. And you just keep resisting and resisting and resisting. And now that's enough. I'm not going to contend with you anymore. I'm not going to get to you anymore. I think when we talk about people with a seared conscience, I think in some cases you're talking about people where God has gotten to the point where he just says, I have done everything that I ever would have been obligated to do to try to reach you. And you've continued to resist and resist and resist. I'm just going to let you suffer the consequences of your own choices.
Okay. Now that was a New Testament reference, questioning someone's tragic, I guess, fall.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask the second question or the next question with the presumption that eternal security also existed in the Old Testament.
Okay.
Did Balaam, son of Beor, lose his salvation? My understanding is that he was a prophet. God spoke through him on many occasions, and he died to the Israelites.
Yeah.
That God commanded.
Right. I think it's important to remember with Balaam that, again, context, definitions, all that stuff matter. And the way I'm understanding scripture, as I'm reading it and I'm understanding it, is Balaam isn't actually called a prophet. In other words, the terminology that's used for him is not prophet, and it's not seer, but he's called a diviner.
Okay, if you could just explain the difference, diviner and a prophet, because they both seem to have been an oracle from God.
Absolutely. I think that what you see is you have prophets. So if we're going to try to like nail down a hard definition, a prophet, would be somebody who's got some sort of semi-formal status as a messenger of God. You have seers, people who maybe can, get messages from time to time. But diviners, I think in the Old Testament, when you hear the scriptures talk about a diviner, it's talking about what we would define today as things like Long Island medium or fortune tellers or psychics. I think a good example of that is the Witch of Endor, the one that Saul went to see.
Yeah.
Saul was the king. He went to see the Witch of Endor. Well, she was a diviner in that sense, that she was basically taking money in order to do this hoodoo, semi-fake, mostly nonsense kind of a thing. And when she actually saw Samuel, she was scared because she wasn't used to this actually getting her in contact with some sort of a real entity. I think with Balaam, the fact that he's referred to as a diviner and he's doing this stuff in exchange for money, I think Balaam is in the same category where you can see that when he actually gets a response, when he actually gets a message from God, he seems a little freaked out. And that's why he starts saying, I don't think I can say what this God doesn't want me to say. I don't want to test this moment. And I think the other reason that I'm comfortable in that mindset is the donkey that's involved in that same story. I don't think that donkey was a prophet.
True.
However, the donkey did see something spiritually true, and that donkey was given the ability by God to say something spiritually true. In other words, I don't think that just because somebody says something that legitimately is from God doesn't necessarily mean that every part of that person's life is approved of or touched by God. If God can make a donkey talk, he can take a charlatan, he can take a fraud like Balaam and actually speak a message through him just to make a point.
Wow. So was the donkey a diviner?
I just think the donkey was just a donkey. I don't think the donkey was saved. I don't think the donkey was a prophet. I think that the inclusion of that, I think, helps us to remember that just because some person or creature says something true. In other words, the test for a false prophet is not a two-way valve.
Okay.
You know, and so just because somebody says something true doesn't make them a true prophet. If they give a false prophecy, that's absolute proof that they are not speaking on behalf of God. But just because somebody says something true would not automatically mean, oh, everything this person says and does is fully endorsed by God. So I'm not the kind of person who looks at Balaam and says, yes, this was a prophet just like Elisha and Elijah and Moses, who had a real true relationship with God. I don't think he did.
Yeah. I mean, and also for the listeners, I don't believe there are any future references to Balaam that were positive, including the New Testament as well, too. So
right, that's a good point. He's never mentioned with any positive
references. Yeah. Do you remember what kind of death he requested from God?
Not off the top of my head. I do know that the general idea of his story was that the king of a foreign nation said, I want you to pronounce a curse.
Yeah.
And Balaam said, well, I'll pray about it. And he got a surprising answer, which was don't.
Yeah.
And then he said, I don't think I can. And the king said, well, I'll pay you more. And he said, well, let me pray about it. And God said, don't.
Yeah.
And he kept pushing it. Eventually, God said, you know what? Go ahead.
Yeah, let's play this.
Go ahead. Out. You go ahead and you talk and you say whatever you think you need to say. But I think Balaam was really caught off guard by the interaction that he had.
Okay. Yeah, that was a fun side note. I actually did a little bit of research into Balaam. Maybe about a couple months ago. He was a very unique character in the Bible, and I had a lot of questions about him. But I'm going to save that for another podcast, as well as even discussions about false prophecy. That's like another series in itself. I'm going to attempt to move on to the next question.
Sure.
Now, we're going to leave the earthly realm for this one here. And the question is, did Lucifer, you know, the musician, the best musician ever, who became Satan, did he lose salvation when he was casted out of heaven?
I would say that Lucifer or Satan didn't lose salvation when he was cast out of heaven because he was not saved in the first place. I mean, salvation implies a rescue from something. So to make a parallel, for example, with Adam and Eve, didn't go from saved to fallen and back to saved. They went from unfallen to fallen to saved.
Interesting.
Angels, so far as we can tell in Scripture, don't have access to the salvation that we do. When they sin, that's it. They just get judgment. They don't have the opportunity to get the mercy or the forgiveness that we do. And I think that's one of the reasons the Bible talks about angels looking with interest and wonder at what God is doing with humanity. So I would say that Lucifer didn't lose his salvation. He fell. He lost his communion with God. He lost his relationship with God. He lost all of those things. But he didn't lose salvation because it was never something he had in the first place. Salvation is the rescue. It's the remedy. It's the cure for being fallen.
Gotcha. All right. Next question. Can a Christian take the mark of the beast and therefore lose their salvation? I'm trying to dance around this salvation topic from a number of different angles.
That's so you very can good.
Be it's as clear as possible.
Yeah, I think that's good. And I with the mark of the beast, beyond the fact that we don't know exactly what that's going to entail, super specifically, everything that we read in Scripture implies that people who take the mark are doing so knowing exactly what it implies. So let's look at something like the sinner's prayer, just to make a broad analogy. You know, in theory, the sinner's prayer is when somebody says, this is me using my brain and my mouth and my prayer to formally sort of tell God, this is what I think and this is what I believe. You know, and it's not literally that anybody believes that a sinner's prayer is, it's not a ritual that saves a person, but we sort of point to that as a moment that says, look, a person who says that, does that, believes that, that means something about their relationship with God and Jesus. Taking the mark of the beast is sort of like the antimatter or the anti-sinner's prayer to that. that when a person takes the mark of the beast, they are sort of formally declaring to society, to themselves, or it's almost like an anti-baptism where they're saying, I am making a public statement. I am saying I do not accept this Christian God, this Christ, this whatever. My faith, my loyalty, my allegiance is to this other thing. So I don't think that that's somebody who's losing salvation. I think the reason that the Bible talks about everyone who takes the mark of the beast being irrevocably damned is because everybody who does is doing so because they are willingly, knowingly, deliberately turning away from the one true God.
This concludes another episode of Beyond Sermons, where we seek Jesus Christ beyond the pulpit. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support, please visit beyondsermons.com to rate and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. God bless, and be blessed to be a blessing.